So exactly. One final thing I want to ask you about is I noticed looking through these cases that you had a patient who got T-VEC, and I want to kind of get an update of where that is. This is a 21-year-old. What happened there?
This was a patient who had this, you know, recurrence of disease that was, you know, in transit, as we call it, you know, these dermal metastases. Well, then lymph node actually was the first thing that was injected in her case, but then she had the in transits. And T-VEC, that's right in the sweet spot of when T-VEC was tested prospectively in phase 2 and then phase 3 trials.
Maybe you can just backtrack and explain what T-VEC is.
It's a herpes virus that's basically replication incompetent. So when you inject it, it can't, you know, disseminate, you know, widely as an active herpes virus. But it will survive in the tumor cell long enough to be able to induce expression of GM-CSF. So it's actually genetically engineered, the herpes virus, to express or deliver the gene that expresses GM-CSF, which is a, you know, cytokine that's been of interest in melanoma for a long time. And if you can express high local concentrations of that stuff, you know, it would appear that you can then induce a local immune response. So that was the design of T-VEC, was to basically use the herpes virus as a carrier to get the GM-CSF gene in there, induce GM-CSF expression, and then invite in dendritic cells and inflammatory responses. Clearly, it does that. And as you probably recall from the phase 2 and phase 3 data, one of the issues was that you could get a response in injected lesions pretty reliably. But the issue is, do you have an effect beyond that? Because a patient like this, you know, very worrisome initial presentation, even more worrisome, you know, recurrence, stage 3 recurrence initially. These patients are, you know, inordinately likely to develop subsequent metastatic disease. So if you're thinking about, you know, T-VEC as an approach, you want a systemic effect. You know that you're going to be facing recurrent disease in 80, 90% of these patients systemically. So the point being that in this case, it was used very much on label, kind of right in the way that T-VEC was investigated in trials. And when you looked at the subset data from the phase 3 trial of T-VEC, it was these exact patients, these stage 3B, 3C, or even in the M1A category, who seemed to even have an overall survival improvement, suggesting a systemic effect. Now, the fact is that all of that data was very interesting at the time, but with the immune checkpoints coming, and of course, BRAF-MEK therapy coming as well, as much more active systemic therapies, one wonders, like, what's the place for T-VEC anymore, right? Because even in this exact patient who presents with this stage 3 recurrence, wouldn't you just use that as a window to now initiate, you know, these much more systemically impactful therapies that you know would high likelihood would give you a local response as well. So, you know, turning all this and putting to the scenario now where you have a patient who presents with metastatic disease of some kind and they have an injectable lesion, you know, is there a role for giving T-VEC, let's say, for a few weeks before you start your quote-unquote definitive systemic therapy? Or in a patient who's been getting systemic therapy but has residual disease that's injectable, do you use that lesion to deliver T-VEC to be able to try to augment, you know, the systemic response and the immune response? These are the questions that the field's wrestling with now post the approval of T-VEC. But remember, when it was developed, it was tested by itself as, you know, kind of, you know, standalone therapy. That's just not how it's going to, you know, get incorporated if it is maintained as a treatment approach in the field.
Well, the thing that I wondered about is I heard about these issues in terms of how you actually do the injection and like the infection precautions and stuff. It sounded like it was kind of a hassle.
Yes.
Is it?
It is, unfortunately. It needs to be treated, you know, essentially like a live virus. You know, so as I said, it's replication incompetent, but that doesn't take it below the radar of how a practice or an institution handles it. So it has to be in a special pharmacy, has to be, you know, refrigerated in special conditions. You can't keep the stuff around forever, right? So you have to kind of refresh your stock, you know, pretty frequently. So there's all of those issues. And then in terms of the administration part, basically just you need to have a non-pregnant practitioner. That's kind of rule number one. But otherwise, it's pretty straightforward. You inject, you know, the volume that you basically mix up of the stuff, you'll inject it across the lesions that you're dealing with. If you have one large lesion, you try to put it all in there. If you've got a few small lesions, you try to, you know, distribute it across. And that's not perfectly codified, right? In the clinical trial that established the benefit of the approach, you know, different patients were treated differently in terms of exactly, you know, how you use the material, if you will. So yeah, there's some art involved in terms of how to incorporate it into practice.
So final question, I see that this woman actually had a BRAF positive disease and that you, I guess we're thinking about, or maybe you already have initiated systemic therapy. I see too, PD-L1 IHC negative.
It's a real tricky issue about, okay, she has a BRAF mutation and she's PD-L1 negative. Does that make it then obvious that you give BRAF-MEK because she would have a, you know, 10-15% likelihood of response to PD-1 antibody and she has a, you know, 70% response likelihood to BRAF-MEK? Some practitioners would say, yeah, that's exactly how and why I would use a PD-L1 test. My objections I already made before. So in fact, in talking with her, you know, when she was referred to me with all of that data available, I told her, look, I can't confidently incorporate that result in decision making. What I can tell you is we've got these two approaches. You know, they're both certainly on the table. Because she's so young, PD-1 CTLA-4 as a combination approach, even with its not magnificent benefit at the level of overall survival, it's the young, what I kind of refer to as the young, highly motivated. These are the patients who we used to talk about high-dose IL-2 with. You know, those kinds of patients, when you have a conversation about PD-1 monotherapy versus PD-1 CTLA-4, you find more, you know, traction, if you will, for throwing the kitchen sink there with the combination. So it's that combination versus BRAF-MEK combination was the relevant discussion with her. She ended up choosing PD-1 CTLA-4 combination as the initial approach, with BRAF-MEK then as the backup.
Yeah, that's kind of what I predicted when I saw this case. How did she do?
She didn't respond to PD-1 CTLA-4 after, you know, basically only two induction cycles and severe toxicity that precluded getting more. You know, she kind of basically hit the stopping point on induction therapy after two rounds, and at least at that point didn't have evidence of a response. So she switched to BRAF-MEK right at that point.
Which combination?
Dabrafenib-trametinib.
What kind of toxicity did she have?
So she had colitis and what seemed like gastritis, I mean, you know, true treatment-related gastritis as well. It was symptomatic, led to a scope, and she really did have quite an inflamed gastric mucosa. That's not a very common site of checkpoint-associated, you know, autoimmune toxicity, whereas, of course, the colitis we would comfortably attribute. But because of the timing, they really were at the same exact time frame. We sort of ascribed all of that to being checkpoint antibody-related. But she needed steroids. So basically, someone who hits that level of toxicity is, you know, at least for the time being, done with immune checkpoint therapy in our practice.